Hello?
Hey, Bill Ferris.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Dom Flemons, the American Songster. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Dom.
Well, I want to know if you want to come down to the studio and share some songs with me. I got a new segment talking about some three songs that changed your life. Do you think you could do that for me?
Nothing I'd rather do, Dom. I'll be right down.
All right. Hello, folks, from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is American Songster Radio. I'm Dom Flemons. Today on the show, we're talking about songs that changed your life. My guest is Bill Ferris. He came of age in Mississippi at a time when rock and roll was pushing boundaries.
Internalized that song. My sisters called me Billy Bo because I would sing it, and I still sing it. I love this song.
I share Bill's love for Bo Diddley, Elvis, and the rock and roll pioneers, but today I decided to pull out some songs that inspired me to pick up an instrument and play.
If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land.
We'll have more from Pete and Elvis and Johnny and Bo Diddley and a lot more picks from Bill and me from this show in just a moment on American Songster Radio. Stick around. Well, folks, I'm joined in the studio by my friend Bill Ferris from the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Bill, you picked Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley as your first song. Now, why'd you pick this one?
Well, it was a song that broke the ice for me into the worlds of rock and roll, and it was a revolutionary sound for my generation and for all America, really. There were records burned. People thought it was a dangerous sound. Well, it was dangerous. It was the opening of the gates of black music for white America.
Oh, wow.
And it was Elvis Presley who broke those worlds open for us. And Heartbreak Hotel is a classic, clean, elegant rock and roll sound that I will always look back on as a kind of moment in my life that I will treasure.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just a lonely, I could die.
The Heartbreak Hotel, of course, is one of the songs that Elvis did when he went to a major label for the first time. Were you familiar with any of his work before then, or was Heartbreak Hotel the start and then you went back to that?
No, I had heard him from the time he came out and began recording. We were listening and dancing to his music. It was like we were charting new ground. And our parents would turn the radios off when we were listening to him, and it was the talk of the school. I remember sitting in the library with a beautiful woman that was a student, my classmate, and she turned to me and says, "What do you think of Elvis Presley?" And I thought, "I think he's the greatest." And she said, "I do too." And I thought, "Wow."
Oh, wow. And now you mentioned them burning records and things like that. I guess probably most of the audience wouldn't be familiar with that sort of thing. Now you can't burn a download.
Yeah.
Well, you can, but it ain't the same thing as it was back then. But just give a little picture of what that meant and symbolized to people back then. Like,
well, it was the idea of Jim Crow ending, and it was ending through music. We were burning the barriers of discrimination. It was the early roots of civil rights, and rock and roll was part of that. It was a way of, if you were not living in a community with blacks, you could listen to the music. But in the South, black and white homes were within a block or two in many communities, And that was a kind of bonding that was very, very powerful. The 50s and rock and roll music laid the foundation for the 60s and civil rights.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome.
They'll be so lonely they could die.
Geez, after that, now I'm a little afraid to play my first one, but I'll play it anyway. Another one about speaking of civil rights. This is a song that actually got me to first play the banjo and also really first think about folk music as a force for justice and as a way to get the word out about things that needed changing. And so this is a demo recording that Pete Seeger did for People's Songs in the late 1940s. And so I just thought that this was just a great recording here. Let's get a little bit of this one. Pete singing If I Had a Hammer.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land.
Yeah, I just always love that piece. Just really, just unabashed Pete, and then also his the wacky little banjo lines he does. Especially in that early period, just those cascading little bass lines between, I always really appreciate that. And then very short track, too. He's just right to the point with it. And, you know, that was one of the things I also found when I was discovering the music. I realized that there were two worlds of the music. There were people that actually had been involved with the community of music for years and years. Because, see, I started singing that melody on If I Had a Hammer, and I was actually quickly stopped by a lot of my elders because they knew the Peter, Paul, and Mary version, which is a slightly mm-hmm. different melody, and people would correct me, well, no, that's not really the melody. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden I realized there were two worlds where I was able to go into the archives and find these different melodies than the more familiar versions or melodies of certain songs. And it was really interesting to be able to have that sort of interplay going on to where I was able to talk to people about the source recordings and then also talk about the culture that people had made around, you know, Pete afterward. And so it was really interesting because even in the liner notes he talks about, they said, well, you know, Pete said, well, both the melodies kind of intermix with each other. So I always sing my melody and then the crowd sings the Peter, Paul, and Mary melody, and it works in perfect harmony together. So it was really interesting sort of a thing to be able to hear Pete first this way and then be able to find out about his history afterward. So it was really great. It gave me a good jump from the Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes that I had been listening to previously up to that point.
It's the hammer of justice, it's the bell of freedom. It's the song about love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
Well, Bill, it's your turn here. What's another song you got here for us on American Songster Radio this time around?
Well, my next step after Elvis Presley was Elias McDaniel from Macomb, Mississippi, better known as Bo Diddley. His signature piece was Hey Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley had a farm. Well, that farm he had some women.
What a heavy sound he had. Oh, makes me wish some of the hip-hoppers would pick up some Bo Diddley and grab a square guitar and some rockers and a drum, you know? But, Bill, tell me about the first time you heard Hey Bo Diddley.
It was like a religious experience, like a crossroads experience, and I internalized that song. My sisters called me Billy Bo because I would sing it, and I still sing it. I love this song and the Bo Diddley beat, that rhythmic beat with his maracas player, Jerome Green. He's taking childhood ditties and making them rock and roll with an Afro-American call and response, Hey Bo Diddley. And he would drive audiences wild. There would be riots at his concerts because that power of the music that he played was unlike anything that had ever been heard.
Wow.
And I had the honor of meeting him once in Oxford, Mississippi. And then we had at a concert, and then we had breakfast afterward the next morning at Smitty's. And I thought, life will never get better than this. He was my great, great hero. And for me, rock and roll, there's Elvis Presley, Heartbreak Hotel, and Bo Diddley's Hey Bo Diddley. That's the cornerstones of the great rock and roll sounds.
Oh, that's amazing. I remember that I came through Bo Diddley secondhand through when I was into the 60s folk music. I was in all the rock music that was coming along at that time, and starting out with Dylan, it doesn't take long to get over to the Animals, who did his Dylan's version of Dave Van Ronk's version of The House of the Rising Sun, and they made a really great big hit record with it. But there was a track on this. One thing I'm really glad about is that I came up in the era when they were putting out all the best reissues of everything. So it was like at one point you had to get your one record at a time, but for me it was like big CDs that had the whole collection of different artists. And there was a track on the Animals, it was a best of, and it was called The Story of Bo Diddley. And they tell the whole story of rock and roll from the beginning, and then it ends with a whole monologue talking about the first time they met Bo Diddley, and that they were sitting there playing Hey Bo Diddley, and they said, well, who should walk into the room but the man himself, Bo Diddley? And he had his fine sister, the Duchess, there, who played guitar with him, and then they had Jerome Green. And it's a whole thing about Bo Diddley sitting and looking at these English guys playing Bo Diddley and saying, like, I can't tell if they play or can play well or not. And so he looks over at Jerome and says, Jerome, what do you think of these guys playing on material? And Jerome says, take me to the bar. Someone please take me to the bar, please. and he asked the Duchess, and the Duchess says, well, I don't know about all these cats up on the stage. I just came here to see the London Tower and the changing of the guards. And so then Bo Diddley comes up, and he takes off his glasses and says, you guys are playing the worst type of music I ever heard. And then they start singing Hey Bo Diddley. But so it's like it's a really great track. It breaks down Elvis and the Stones, mm-hmm. and the Beatles, and then kind of that era when rock and roll receded, and then the pop singers came in. It's really some great stuff there. So, I'm loving what you're putting there. I can't wait to hear your third selection. But let me throw one at you here. With kind of linking in with Bo Diddley, one of the guys that really got me thinking about what types of music, what types of black folk music are outside of the kind of the normal things that I'd been aware of, like the blues or jazz or country music. One of the first guys was Henry Thomas, and he was a musician who played with this instrument called the quills that I became quite obsessed with. I just could not figure out what they were at first, and then when I met the great Mike Seeger, Pete's brother, he introduced me to them. And this is a song here called The Fox and the Hounds that he recorded in 1928. And this is just an amazing, amazing piece of folklore and also just a great piece of music. But let me play this one for you, The Fox and the Hounds from Henry Thomas. One that's an old square dance number, and even though they're 30 years apart, it's amazing to see how Henry Thomas and Bo Diddley both jump into that beat and bring that drive to it, even though they're playing their different instruments. And that's one of the things I've always thought was absolutely amazing, is a lot of the early rock and roll from the 50s, when people were still coming from these very regional styles and adapting them, how much stuff translates over just directly. I mean, that was a great conduit for me. I don't know if that was anything that you've ever sat and thought about before, Bill, like kind of how R&B and how folk music and all this old stuff kind of mixed together at all.
Yeah, they're all connected. And I was thinking about what he's doing there. That's an extraordinary recording. It's like four or five things are running on parallel tracks. There's the sound of the dogs barking and whooping, and then there are the quills playing and the instrument and his voice. It's an incredibly complex recording that in many ways embodies everything about folk music and the history. And you can just assume that those early sounds are the foundation for the later generations. I teach my students sacred harp singing and shape notes, and I tell them there's no traditional singer who does not know what this music is. Mm. You talk to Doc Watson, and he and others of his generation immediately will say, well, I remember learning those hymns and learning to read the shape notes. And these are foundation blocks, like the spirituals in the Black Church. You can listen to a rapper and talk to a hip-hop artist. They know what spirituals are. They may not sing them per se, but that is a foundation block, along with the blues, for the Black music today. Beyoncé is weaving in Lemonade the rich, complex musical worlds of the Black experience and of the Creole New Orleans sound, where rock and roll was really forged, from the islands coming into this country. The birth of rock and roll and jazz and gospel were all created there, and Beyoncé goes like a bead of honey there for her inspiration. Mm. So whatever the cutting-edge sounds are, we can assume that those artists understand the roots of Henry Thomas's sounds and of sacred harp music. And Pete Seeger told me how he was drawn, like you, to the banjo, and he first heard that instrument when his father, Charles Seeger, brought him to Asheville, North Carolina, to the folk festival, and he heard Samantha Baumgartner playing her banjo, which had a beautiful decoration on it, and it was an insect, a beautiful and a flower, and it was from that he was inspired, and also from Woody Guthrie, to decorate his cover of his banjo with "This Banjo Kills All Evil," and he saw the banjo as an instrument for social change. But he built that concept, a butterfly was what Samantha Baumgartner had on hers, but Pete was taking the inspiration of the roots music into the streets of protest music. But it's all connected. Music is how we reach across and build bridges of understanding and No one does this better than you, Don.
Oh. Oh, you're too kind, Bill. Bill, would you mind playing us one more?
Sure. Let's go back to Memphis, to Sun Records, to one of that million-dollar quartet, Johnny Cash, and I Walk That Line.
All right.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
All right, the man in black with Tennessee 2, Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line. Bill, can you tell me a little bit about how you first heard this song as well?
Well, the way I heard all of these on the radio, and you just, it stops you in your tracks and you say, what was that? And then you go back, and eventually, if you've got a dollar or so, you go buy a 45 and play it over and over. But the simplicity of that melody and of his voice, it's like a naked, unadorned sound of the man in black. And Johnny Cash, like B.B. King, reinvented himself decade after decade. He was a darling of the 60s, protest music. He played his great concert in Folsom Prison. The prison community identified with him just at live at Folsom Penitentiary, just as B.B.'s audience responded to Cook County Jail, his album there. And Johnny Cash married into aristocracy. He came out of Arkansas, working class, sharecropping family, and he married June Carter, the aristocracy of country music from the Upland South.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Yeah, I think about Johnny Cash a lot and the way that he was able to make stuff his own. And even on I Walk the Line, I was thinking about it too. For a lot of folks, when we hear a pop singer do their big vocal tricks, we usually think of them going higher up in the scale. So they'll sing like here, and then by up here, and then a little up here, up here. And I love the way that Johnny Cash used that trick a lot of the country singers would use, which is just go real, real low. You know, they'd be mm-hmm. singing in their regular tone, and then they would go a lot lower. Like people like Conway mm-hmm. Twitty used to do that a lot, and you know, people like Rick Springfield as well and stuff. And that's something I've always admired about Johnny Cash, is that he never breaks his stoic tone in his singing, and that's something that's just going to be really praised, especially now when singers usually sing so much. They sing so many notes now. It's something that drew me in as well. That's some beautiful stuff. And also, I guess for the listeners, I'll mention two things that Bill's mentioned about all of these. These songs were on the radio, so hopefully this is advocacy to get these songs on the radio again. And then, two, that vinyl is amazing. And Bill didn't say it in that many words, but I'm just going to run with it and say, you know, vinyl records are the way to go.
Hear, hear. It's our future.
Yep. Yeah, there's a. It's hard to count single downloads, but we can definitely count single records when they get sold, and then also you have an artifact for life when you buy a record. You know, we don't know what will happen to downloads. You know, what happens if, when it crashes? It's gone. But thinking about, I guess, with Johnny Cash being born more of out of a country music tradition, I just kind of wanted to throw out a track that really changed my perception of country music and blues and what songs are okay for different musicians to perform. And that's something that I found in this track here from Blind Willie McTell. You know, a lot of the 20s and 30s musicians, I first heard about them through their later sessions that they did, where they, you know, the people that were really sticklers about it mentioned that they weren't at their prime or their top game or whatnot, but some of those albums are just amazing. Like the first one I heard was Gus Cannon and the song and the album Walk Right In from Stax, which ends up being the first record Stax Records put out, which I, again, was another interesting digression off to the side. But the other one I heard was one called Blind Willie McTell, The Last Session, and it was originally done on a wire recording machine done by a fellow named Ed Rhodes, and it just catches Blind Willie McTell in as close as we'll get to a live setting of him playing. And so he does a version of the song The Wabash Cannonball, which is a very famous country music number, but the way he sings it, something about it really struck me. But let me put it on for you here.
From the great Atlantic Ocean to wide Pacific shore, to the queen of the flowing mountain, south of Baltimore. She's mighty tall and handsome, yet known quite well by all. She made a modern combination on that Wabash cannonball.
And hearing that track for the first time, it got me thinking of an idea that, well, see, I knew about it from my own personal experience. My dad grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona, and they had just one radio station at that time, so they just would flip over to the pop station or the country station or the R&B station. So he got to know a lot of country music just from the radio. And my mom said that the first time he came down to Phoenix, he was just singing all these country songs. She couldn't understand why there was a black guy that knew all the country hits of that time. And that was that Blind Willie McTell track. It really just got me thinking in a way of saying, well, okay, well, he's not singing this song the same way that, like, Roy Acuff or Doc Watson or the Carter Family might sing that song, but it's its own very interesting version based on Blind Willie's style. And so that really got me thinking about, especially later on when I got into string band music, about, you know, black-white interchange with songs and then how people did songs. You know, you hear classic stories of Robert Johnson doing a great version of My Blue Heaven and songs like that. And it gave a little window into that world. And so that's something that I've always enjoyed is finding those little songs. Like there's a version of Furry Lewis doing the song Waiting for a Train and attempting to yodel, but he doesn't quite get there. But it's to think that all of these different musicians had a broad repertoire beyond just the stuff that they recorded, that was something that was just blowing my mind. And of course, being a young kid coming up in the 90s, it was really like, you know, I had never heard of people like I hadn't heard of Charlie Pride or anything mm-hmm. like that, or knew that black country singing was a thing at all. But of course, when you look into it, of course, it is a very interesting dynamic that's grown out of black country singers, especially also with white blues singers going back and forth. That was a yeah. whole thing. But that track really gave me a whole bunch to think about on that.
Well, you know, Jimmy Rogers covered Blind Willie McTell in one of his blue yodels. He said, "I'd rather sleep in a hollow log than to be in Atlanta treated like a dirty dog." It was a Blind Willie McTell verse that he made into his country sound. And these artists are just what they are as artists. They can mold any music into their sound, and they can shift between country and blues. Blues singers like James Thomas told me that when he had a white audience, he would play country sounds in C as opposed to blues in E.
Oh, wow.
And he would play some of that in his concerts. Indicated he would sort of do that for white audiences, and they would laugh because they would see what the straight white music sounded like, and they wanted the blues without any question. But they could go both ways, and you see that with lots of white country musicians who are performing the blues as well as white country, and vice versa, which is what this world is all about. Music allows us to flow and to move in and out of different skins of people and cultures. And no one owns the blues, or no one owns country. It's, or old time country, as you've shown, can be reclaimed by this generation from what it was thought to be.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Traveling through the jungles, boys, on the Wabash Cannonball.
Well, it looks like we're just about out of time this time around. Bill, thanks for joining us and sharing three songs that changed your life.
Thank you, Dom.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Bill Ferris is the Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's an author, scholar, and I'm happy to say he's a good friend of mine. Bill, thanks for joining us on the American Songster podcast.
My pleasure.
Well, folks, it's come that time again when I'm going to play you a song from the different tunes I've picked up on my travels. And this one here, since on my last song that I picked with Bill, was the Blind Willie McTell Wabash Cannonball. It got me thinking about a lot of the country songs I've picked up over the years. And when I first started playing, it was one of those things where people would wonder, why was I playing these country music songs when I was of African descent, we'll say. That was something that just kind of, you know, didn't mean anything to me when I started playing. And I just liked the songs and wanted to get them out there. So this is an old Jimmy Rogers number that I picked up, one called My Little Lady. And this is one of the songs that I tried to really put a little bit of the Papa Charlie Jackson blues swing in with Jimmy Rogers, but I wanted to also really try to replicate Jimmy Rogers' style in a big way. So this is a little bit of that one, My Little Lady.
I had a gal, oh what a gal, her name was Haiti Brown. I'd take her out to ride about when the moon was shining down. We'd sit alone when we got home out on the old porch swing. Then that dear little miss would give me a kiss, and sweetly to her I would sing. What would I sing to her? Oh, hey day, my little lady, I love no one but you. Oh, hey day, my little lady, say you love me too. We get married in June, have a long honeymoon, then settle down for life. Oh, hey day, little lady, promise to be my wife. Then what happened? I had a gal, oh what a pal, she left me alone one day. I didn't mind, because I find they most always do you that way. So I went a boat to try to find out if another gal I couldn't find. In less than a day, I met Sadie Mae. Now I hand her the same old lines. What lines is that? Oh, Sadie, my little lady, I love no one but you. Oh, Sadie, my little lady, say you love me too. We're getting married in June, have a long honeymoon, then settle down for life. Oh, Sadie, my little lady, promise to be my wife. Then kick it six.
American Songster Radio is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This episode was produced by David Brower and me, Dom Flemons, the American Songster. There are more episodes up on iTunes, Google Play, and just about everywhere else people are sharing podcasts. Please listen, subscribe, and tell a friend. This is Dom Flemons, the American Songster. I'll see you next time.